what type of VC are you? Are you going to follow up or not? Are you actually going to be hands-on and help me? VCs, we also tell a lot of stories and we oversell. The same as like a founder will say, like, hey, I'm going to build a $1 billion company. I'm going to tell the company and the founder as well, well, I'm going to help you in everything, like with HR, with, you know, technical.
This is no bullshit gaming podcast, 2.5 gamers, sharing actionable insights, dropping knowledge from our day-to-day user acquisition, game design, and ad monetization jobs. We are definitely not discussing the latest industry news, but having so much fun. Let's not forget this is a 4 a.m. conference discussion vibe, so let's not take it too seriously.
Okay, let's do it. Welcome, everybody. My name is Mattia Lancerich.
And I'm Felix Broberg.
And we have a special guest, Ignacio Monreal, a.k.a. Nacho. Welcome, Nacho. We are very happy to have you here. This is going to be a special episode. But okay, first, before we go into the questions and then the discussion, since you're very, very well known in the industry because you work at Google, Facebook, well, Meta, I guess, now Boost Capital, can you just walk us through the career, the thought process of like starting a venture company and all of the fun stuff?
Yeah. Well, I mean, first of all, thank you, Matej. I'm a big fan of the podcast, so thank you very much for inviting me here. And I guess when I read that very well known in the industry, I don't consider myself as that.
Oh, come on! Everybody knows you.
Yeah. No. I have the probably the. Should I make that joke like the cheesiest name in the industry? So, I mean, how many times like you meet a natural, right? It's just like, anyway. So, yeah. So, when you ask the question about like how do I ended up here and at Boost Capital, I was talking to Felix before. Yeah. So, kind of like ended up in games a bit random, to be honest. I've never been like 100% pure gamer. My parents, they didn't like me to spend time playing video games. Classic.
Rude. Yeah.
Yeah. But my first console was a Master System 2. So you can imagine like it was a terrible one. But yeah, like I used to spend a lot of time playing with my cousin and so I guess like in my mind, in the back of my mind, I wanted to be a gamer.
Nice.
Although I wasn't allowed at home. So how I ended up here started kind of like a weird path. So ended up at Google, started in 2012. I was talking to Felix. I worked 4 years in the ad monetization team.
Yeah, there you go.
Doing the Lord's work.
Yeah. Yes. Kind of like we were saying that we were plastering the internet with ads because we were working on web and apps. Apps was very limited at the time. We only had the 320x50 and the interstitials. I remember when incentivized and rewarded videos came out, and Google was very, very much at the very beginning, not following the trend. So kind of like for us, it was like, oh, you know, 320x50, you know, Felix, like the CPMs are horrendous. So yeah, so I started in at Google in 2012 doing that. And also was like working with AdMob, with AdExchange, DFP. And it was the time of, I'd say, early hyper-casual, like the Flappy Bird, then Fingersoft, the very beginning of Ketchup and Vudu. So Ketchup mostly before the acquisition.
Yeah.
So it was super interesting. A lot of, you know, that story of two students in a dorm launching an app and all of a sudden becoming millionaires. And that was like one after the other. So did that for 4 years. In 2016, I moved to the Google Play team. At the time, Google Play was super interesting, mostly because there was a challenge. Like, probably you don't recall that, but, well, I mean, you don't recall it. We all forgot, but games developers that were not launching simultaneously on Google Play and iOS. Most of the times they were launching on iOS, and there was like a real challenge for us on the Android team trying to persuade developers to test in Android, right? Like that kind of like
My. Today's... Things change.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's changing right now, but I remember discussing with Monument Valley 2, for example, had an exclusivity launch in iOS for a year. And they negotiated that, and that was like for us was okay. We need to push harder. We need to kind of like get Monument Valley into our phones at the same time, because obviously this has an impact. If you're choosing, like, if you're designing to buy an iPhone or an Android phone, not having some of these games was a must. Was a loss, right? So that was kind of like the idea why for me Google Play was super interesting. And ended up 4 years
was
there.
Was that only cash incentives then you're like trying to convince people with, or was it more like being featured Play Store?
It's always been no cash involved, mostly, you know, like the classic promotions tools, like featuring and partnering with us in the end, like, and giving you access to pitas or being part of, like, a managed team. And so there's more like more given, like, more support basically. We didn't have any cash. Perhaps that's the reason why some people were locked in.
On iOS, I remember the days when you were kind of exclusive to iOS, that you got quite a big promotion on the iOS store.
Correct. So that was 2016. That obviously has evolved a lot. But during my 4 years at Play, I worked with a bunch of game developers. I was always super interested in working with smaller developers, like startups.
Nice.
Perhaps because I still believe, like, you know, you could see those startups like really, really accelerating and becoming big companies. And so it was super thrilling to work with the CEOs directly. So work with DuckDuck Games, Hutch Games, Small Giant Games, First Touch Games, and, for example, Matt Age, you were talking the other day about the Legion, so Traplight, obviously very close to my heart. We did a case study. This week is Playtime. For Google Play. I'm not invited anymore. I think it was 2019 or 2018 I did a case study.
2018, for sure, 2018. I was there in Berlin, 100%.
And it was like a Battle Legion case study. So it was nice to hear that. So kind of like worked 4 years in that side. And I think I'm coming all the way back because at the time, that's when I started like also interacting with VCs. I was part of an initiative called the Launchpad, Android Launchpad. Google was very interested in partnering with VCs from the very get-go. And the reason was we saw that there was an opportunity, like companies that were backed by VCs, they had a higher chance of success. And therefore, like, we needed to be like very close to these companies. And so I started talking with the VCs at the time. So Initial Capital, Play Ventures was starting because they launched the first fund in 2018. It was Makers, LVB mostly.
Yep.
So some of the European traditional gaming funds, and that's kind of like how I ended up a bit like interacting with whoever is today my partner at Boost Capital, which is Alvaro. He was in Initial Capital from the very get-go. And so, so I think that's kind of like, the first moment. If I fast forward like 2020, move to Facebook, jumped from Google Play to Facebook, I had a very good opportunity to work with a super nice person, a great exec. You probably know him, Bob Slynn from...
I know Bob. FunPlus. Always amazing.
FunPlus. Yeah, so he basically came to me and said, hey, Nacho, do you want to come and work in Facebook gaming, leading all the video initiatives in EMEA? And I was like, sure. New area. I've heard about like content creators. All these buzz around content creators in sports and stuff like that. I need to learn about it, right? So jumped in, managed like the team in EMEA, ended up managing as well APAC. Super interesting, learned a lot about like content creators. Very difficult to convince them to play your mobile games for free.
They like cash.
Don't get me wrong, they have an audience and they want to monetize it.
It's a business as well.
Anyway, so great experience working with Bob and the team, and And kind of like, funnily enough, when I was a Google Play, I had some people were coming to me and saying like, hey, Nacho, do you want to take part on our startup? Do you want to kind of like collaborate with us? And for me, it was like a clear conflict of interest, since, you know, I couldn't be at Google Play and then yeah. helping a gaming company. But when I left from Google to Facebook, one of the things that I negotiated was precisely to kind of like be able to invest and advise some of the companies. Okay. So I started investing as an angel investor, invested in Macmatic Games, then in Superscale, which yeah, you guys know very well, and invested in some other studios, like they're still like in
Magic. Nom, nom, nom. Well done.
Yes, I was very lucky and had a great experience. So yeah, Magmatic, I know Florian very well, and I was a board of server, so I really enjoyed. And that's nice. That's how I ended up. You know, 3 years later, Alvaro, who as I mentioned, I used to know from that Android launchpad. Then, funnily enough, we invested together. Like initial capital was like is in three companies that I angel invested myself. So
you have a history as well.
Yeah. So when he came last year and he said, "Hey, I'm putting together." Finally, I'm launching my own fund. Would you like to join? I said, like, this is, you know, super interesting, and I've been doing this. Let me try. And
yeah, so, okay. Yeah,
this is how we ended up in Boost Capital today.
Okay, so what kind of requirements or skills you need to do here for your job? Like, how can you become a partner like a VC company, basically?
Yeah. Well, look,
it's tough. And from the outside, it looks very, very hard, honestly.
It is. I think it is hard. I think you need to be lucky. And I guess in my case, I was lucky that that Alvaro gave me this opportunity. So I'm not going to be honest with you. I'm not sure if I would get like many opportunities like this one. I think in order to do the job, If you think about like the classic two areas, like soft skills and hard skills, mm-hmm. this is a lot about like relationships, right? And these are very people skills, business. So you need to be very good at sales and business development. So I think some of the skills when you work on the Google Play Store, managing a lot of like companies or like in sales, like as I was mentioning in Atmo, it helps you because in the end, when you're at the VC, you're doing very much like same thing. I guess you need to be very, very flexible, curious to learn a lot of things, make decisions without not much information, and have a little bit of common sense but unrealistic optimism, that I say.
Okay.
Which is you need to believe that the world can change, and that's hard. But those would be kind of like some of the soft skills. If I think about hard skills, some of the things that I studied economics and finance. So some of the things that helped me is that even though I'm coming from the platform side, previously my experience was in finance. I studied as an auditor for PwC. So you can imagine like how boring that was like when I started. But that helps me when it comes to understanding business models, like market sizing, trying to make a sense whether the business is viable or not, and you can actually build a large company. And so those kind of like hard skills perhaps are useful as well. One of the things that I'm lacking, and I believe that a lot of good investors can do, is more technical skills when it comes to, you know, coding background. Like if you're in tech and you understand how things work, actually,
yeah, okay.
That actually gives you an edge. As well, if you're an operator, and that's why you see a lot of VCs that the partners are coming from, you know, exited founders. And the reason is because they've lived through all the experience of launching in a company, and so they can add more value than someone like me that I'm coming from the platform side.
Ah, come on. I think you have very good background to be able to kind of understand, or maybe how do I call it, just predict which company is going to to do well or not? Because you've kind of met a lot of founders and you've worked with smaller companies.
I mean, definitely, like, I've seen a lot of companies succeeding and failing, and you can, like, as I said, like, I lived, like, through even, like, through AdMob, I saw a lot of companies launching. But also, like, when it was at Google Play, I saw loads of companies that they started very, very small, and then they made it all the way to the top. And you're very biased because you tend to skew towards, like, the already, if you're talking to Google, that means that, you reach a certain level of success. Yeah. So you're biased, but you can find, like, common areas, common things that they work, and that helps you. That's for sure, especially when it comes also to benchmarks, when it comes to trends. That's something like it does help you. However, let's be honest, there's a big lack component in this business, which you never know. There's a lot of things that need to happen in order to be successful as a venture capital.
So what you're saying also kind of is you need to have a good network so you keep getting access to these founders, right?
As I said, this is a people's business. This is about, like, expanding your network, making sure that you stay very humble, and everybody that knocks at your door, you listen, because you never know who's actually going to be the next $1 billion founder.
Yeah, that's true. But then, like, if you're getting, like, hundreds or thousands of, like, pitch decks, like, every day, like, it can be quite annoying. Like, you can't just listen to everybody. I mean, I guess you can, but it's not as easy.
I agree with you. You need to have some filters. This is similar to when you are looking at games, right? Like, I remember we were doing the indie games contest at Google Play, and there were, like, I don't know, 3,000 submissions. I'm just making up the number, but I remember that we were spending a week playing games, and we're playing games constantly, and there were some minimum requirements. We had to play the game at least for 10 minutes. We had to kind of, like, rank the game, like, rate the game, like design, game mechanics. There were a lot of things to do. So you kind of, like, you get better at filtering those things, similar with decks and with the startups. And obviously, if it is a startup that it comes recommended, referred by someone, that tends to have, like, a higher degree of quality. Whether it is a cold call through LinkedIn, sometimes perhaps it's less. So you kind of, like, you optimize, but in my case, I always try to at least dedicate enough time to look at the startups and make sure that I'm not missing any opportunity. Or if I miss, it's because it's a misjudgment, or not because I ignore an email.
Okay, and then in that case, like, what's the due diligence process for you? How does it start, and when and where as well?
When you say due diligence process, what do you mean? Do you mean when I start analyzing a company, or like filtering?
Let's say first, filtering, and then start analyzing. So first, I guess, like, you have hundreds of pitch decks, and then, like, filter first, like, how to filter, and then, like, how to start, like, analyzing the company. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I mean, if I start from the deal flow, right?
Yeah.
Where the deal is coming, it matters. As I mentioned before, like, if it comes, like, referred by you, Mateusz, or Felix, basically you share and you tell me, like, oh, this team is amazing.
Yeah.
Definitely that's already,
that's a plus.
It's a good indication, right?
Yeah,
it's a good indication that you already have set up that filtering for myself.
Right? Okay.
So you've done a filter. You will never recommend something that you don't think it's good, right? So that's something like you basically categorize a bit like a text based on where it comes from. And depending on that, you will give more attention to the others. But then afterwards, if it is like cold call, then you basically look at the deck and you start, like, looking at things, right? Like the structure of the deck, how is it, and whether it's like I know that you're gonna laugh, but like the team, where is it coming from, what's the product, what's the market, and what's the round details. I think that's for me, like, the four things that I would always consider are kind of like those four things. I mean, there's a lot of caveats, and within team you talk about, like, what's the vision, what are they trying to build, within the product, you go as much in details as you want. If they have already a product in the market and they have some metrics, the market as well, like how they're doing the sizing, is it a large market or is it a small? And then the round details typically sometimes are not included in the first deck, but round details can give you already an idea. Like, are we talking like a Series A or a bridge seed round where the company's in difficulties and they're trying to extend their runway, or is it like a very expensive, is the cap table broken or not? So there's a lot of elements that you will look in the round details, which sometimes is not included and it doesn't have to be. But based on that,
yeah. So Nacho, what's your Goldilocks zone? So let's say I have a company, like when should I be reaching out to Nacho? Like what kind of numbers or KPIs should I be hitting? And then I'm like, Nacho time.
Well, it depends, right? And I guess there's not a perfect answer. It really depends on where, which stage you are. I always say the sooner the better that you reach out to VCs.
Pre-idea? Do you do pre-idea as well? Or?
Yeah. I mean, think about this. Like for us, for me, the sooner I get into a company, the better. Mostly because that's, you know, if you get early, that means that the valuation is very likely to be lower. And so the multiples that you need to make as a VC, they kind of like they don't have to be so big, right? My goal is to find companies that they are fund returners. And fund returners, the size of our funds is $40 million. If I find a company, I get 10% of the company at $4 million valuation, right? And it, I don't know, $400 million exit, it gives me already the $40 million fund that I have, right? And so that's what kind of like 10% no dilution, I'm assuming. So that's kind of like what I'm trying to get that. So the sooner that you get, the better. Pre-idea, it's fine if it is that's kind of like incubating, but I am very happy to have those conversations. I'm having a number of conversations with founders that I know them because they were working in a previous startup, in a previous gaming company, and they're thinking about building their own company, or they are like at Google right now. I have one former colleague at Google thinking about leaving. He wants to leave the big G, and then he's asking me like, what should I do? What are the next steps? So all those kind of like those conversations are good. My only advice is that whenever you talk to a VC, think about that already in some way you're making the pitch. So you have to prepare a little bit, because otherwise there could be, you know, you're starting to be biased yourself. Like as a VC, you're starting to make some judgments about the person. And if the person is doubting a lot in the way, or, you know, changing his or her views, that kind of like can affect you negatively when you have
to. Yeah, like pre-idea, it's all about the people you're talking to. Yeah. I mean, I guess you need to know them from the past or through some recommendations. So it's about the team, right? So the KPI is kind of like that. But that are different KPIs in different stages, I guess.
Maybe I can just restart by asking, like, what's the ticket sizes you guys are currently going for in Boost? And do you guys always do like pro rata, or how does it work for you guys?
Yeah. So the ticket size is in between $250,000 and $750,000 in the kind of like in the first ticket that we do. And we do follow up. So we follow up in subsequent rounds, and we do either pro rata, or if we feel that the company is actually growing and it's one of the companies that we believe that we need to put a lot of support, because it can really increase our chances to, as I mentioned, to deliver a fund returner, then we can increase actually and increase the percentage that we have.
Okay. Nice. And then, so we kind of, wanted to ask about how do you do the homework in terms of the analyzing the companies as well, right?
Yeah. So this goes along a bit with what I meant, with what I mentioned, and I know that team is always it's always like the
most important part. I know.
Well, I mean, if you think about like an idea or like a pre-seed stage company, there's no product to analyze. So if I really like the phrase that there's always more reasons to say no to an investment than to actually say yes. And that's why you need to be a bit optimistic in this job. You need to really believe that things can happen and that magical unicorns can grow from this group of people, because otherwise it's always like, nah, there's already an incumbent who's going to launch another game like Clash Royale. I mean, there's no way you can make it, right? So you have, like, the team is definitely, like, super important. And I can explain a bit more, like, what do we look in the team?
Yeah.
Because it's very subjective, right?
And
as I say, it's a very people business-driven role. So you need to kind of, like, do some due diligence there. But then it's product, market, and the round details. Those are the four areas, in my opinion, and what we look at.
Yeah.
And when we look at the team and the KPIs, one of the most important things is, like, can I work with these people for the next 10 years? And the analogy of the marriage, which is very, as well, stereotype and classic, but this is the reality, right? Our fund is 10 years. There's a 2-year extended period where, like, if the LPs choose to, like, we can still. So we're talking about a long, long time until perhaps we are parting our ways with someone that we're signing today, which means that if the founder, you don't get along with her or him, that will make our lives very painful for both of us. So I think that is essentially, like, you know, super important, that sometimes is often overlooked, because you're looking at the product, the market, and you say, like, oh, let me just jump in. And then you don't realize that, hey, we're gonna struggle. But the things that we're trying to assess is obviously the experience of the founders. And, you know, there's a lot of talk now that you don't raise if you're not, like, a super successful founder. Not necessarily, like, you don't have to. You don't have to come from games and be, oh, I just founded, I don't know, Riot Games before, and then, hey, here I am launching my second company. I think what we're trying to see is that the founders, they have the necessary experience to execute very fast, and whether it's in games or in a different sector, and that is needed, because time is of the essence, and when you're fundraising, you're just buying time. So execution in the team is extremely important. Then also what we're trying to understand very well is, like, if you have more than one founder, how well do they know each other, and what is their motivation? And what you're trying to understand there is that in times of difficulty, which probably they're gonna come very, very soon.
There's gonna be a lot of those.
Is this going to break up easily, or is the team going to really endure and you know, keep pushing? And then, you know, from a VC perspective, you're always investing in companies that they want to reach a sizable size, like a big size, right? A large company.
Yeah.
And it's perfectly fine if you have, like, founders that they want to build a company that is going to be life-changing for them, but is not going to deliver outsized returns. So the vision and ambition from the companies to build a large organization, I think that's also key. And here, I get it, many founders, because they're trying to raise funds, they will say whatever we want to hear.
Exactly.
I mean, our jobs is to essentially try to see that, right?
Yeah.
Like, similar to when you're doing an interview for someone to get a job, and then you
fake it till you make it, basically.
Correct. And that makes sense. Like, we are all telling a story, and what we're trying is to see whether that vision is genuine and you really kind of, like, want to go for it and want to push for it. So those are the things, but then loads of other things that we're looking in teams. Like, we look at, like, how good are they raising funds, for example. You need to have a founder that is going to raise funds, like, now with us, but then later on with other VCs. So how good is it telling the story and really convincing other people? As well, how good is the founder in bringing people on board? Like, we know that a company is not built by one person. So how good is that hiring and how good is that, you know, leading other people, right? In order to kind of, like, deliver and get into the same you know,
what are you doing then when there's like very good experienced team? Then the founder is also very experienced, but he can't tell the story that much. And you see like it's he or she struggling to like with the narrative, but they're really, really good. But then like, you know, they can't kind of persuade you to invest because of reasons. Like what do you do then?
Yeah, that's a very good question. We always try to be conscious of our own biases. And that happens a lot with cultural differences. I'm from Spain. Sometimes we speak to, you know, like people from Asia, from people from you know, from different cultures, like Nordics. And they are just like simply different, right? And the way, you know, I'm very chatty and then they might not. And so, so that kind of like what you're trying is to take your own, you know, be very aware of your own biases and say, well, perhaps it's not great. Is this something that is coachable? Is this something that really matters? And can we help them in any way, right? So if someone is perhaps not the best storyteller, but she is great at delivering and executing, and she can, you know, compensate with, you know, with a lot of results, and also she can be coachable and she can learn, because that in the end is something that you don't acquire. You can educate yourself and become a better presenter. So those type of things, if you see there's potential, then why not? I think you don't need to be extroverted to be a CEO of a company.
Yeah. Okay. Do you also look into like a team structure when the team is trying to get some investments?
Yeah, for sure. The team in games, for example, like having, and this is classic in VC, having a technical founder with like combined with like a more business driven founder, that works well. Because if the CEO can take care of everything that is like from HR, from fundraising, from finance, legal, while the person that is the CTO or the backend engineer is building, game designer is building the actual product, I think that combines pretty well, especially if you have a solid group of founders. So that kind of like trying to map out the roles and then have like a balance. If you have everything on the commercial side, it doesn't mean that it's not going to work, but then you kind of like can spot like they're going to need like at some point some stronger technical person and the other way around.
Do you have like connections to, for example, provide these like types of people? Because some, for example, you know, we are three guys, obviously we don't have anyone from the like technical point of view, and like, okay, but we want to raise money. Like what to do? Like, can you say like, oh, well, we will give you some money, but you know, you can ask these five other guys with a technical background, like you should talk to them and then come back. Or you always say, look, go outside and try to have someone on board.
So, I mean, a combination of both. I've seen like like incubators, like classic situation of an accelerator. They will try to match you up. The issues with that is always comes down to my first question about like team, which is what's the motivation, and do the team have the same vision, right? Like you have a co-founder that wants to sell very quickly because he or she wants to make like a life-changing money and then you know, retire at 30 years old. And then you have another that is like, no, I am like Mark Zuckerberg. I want to kind of like have impact in the world.
Okay.
And I'm not saying good or bad. I'm saying like, I want to have impact. And to do that, you cannot stop at a very small company. You have to really push forward. So, so then that's, you know, that's a key question. But like, to your point, like, do we match? Yes, if we know that there is like a good CTO or like a good like people that we believe that a good person that we believe that would match your skills, I think that's normal. And I've seen like many of the VCs actually doing it and doing it successfully. The question is, they need to agree very well on what they're trying to build, and it has to be some degree of you know, connection, because otherwise can really backfire.
Can I actually jump in here and ask a question about deal flow, right? So Boost Campbell is a new kid on the block. You said you raised 40 million. That usually means that a typical fund that has to close in 10 years, that means that usually you have to deploy the capital in the first 4 years usually. So that means 48 months. That's 160 checks you need to write. So that means every 3 months you need to be investing in about one company. How are you guys going to tackle deal flow? It's quite a lot of competition in our industry right now, especially in mobile. I think it's a very interesting question.
Yeah, well, I mean, a couple of corrections here. Like funds, we're also fundraising. So we've raised 35 million to date. Our target is 40 million, which we can talk about like fundraising, but which is also, is very humbling because it's the same. Like people think like—
With LPs, VCs, right?
Yes, people think that, hey, VCs, they're just like, you know, a bunch of entitled people.
With money and
and it's very humbling because you have to go the other way around and you say like, wait a minute, we also have to raise, or we have to pitch ourselves. But yeah, to your point, like a deal flow. So what we're doing is relying majority of the times in our own network. So that's kind of like why I mentioned that is very much sales, business development, people's business. So I'm kind of like going to conferences and trying to kind of like make sure that people start to know us and we built a brand that if we don't invest in you, at least kind of like we treat you well along the way. Mm-hmm. We give you like meaningful feedback. So in order to help you, and we can even like help some companies in other ways, right? Like not financially, but like I'm always offering like, look, if I cannot invest in you, at least I'm happy to provide detailed feedback on the deck. And also if I can help you with some other things like related to my experience, like in the past, like with Android, you have a question about that, or you need to get like in contact with someone at Meta, I'm gonna try to help you on that front, right? Because perhaps the person that is talking in front of you is not successful with that startup, but is going to be successful with the next one, or know someone that is actually going to be successful and is going to kind of like say, hey, talk to them. So deal flow, it's a lot about network. So on the one hand, like network and cold inflow, there's also another part we're trying to do, which is more trying to be proactive. And with the trends that we see that are interesting, like when you see a trend that is growing and you have what is called long tails, tailwinds. When you have tailwinds in the industry, you know that the companies can grow faster, and then you try to go proactively and reach out to those founders. So that's something like we're also trying to do. We use a number of tools, and whenever we see that someone is leaving a company in order to build something, well, then we proactively reach out to them and try to find out. And then that's another way. And then to closing is hard, right? Because like, as I mentioned before, you need to do the diligence, and it's like team, product, market, and then it's round details. And round details, there's a lot of things, like as I mentioned before, from cap table to valuation to the term sheet and the provisions that you get, like governance, et cetera, et cetera. So all those things, they need to be done, and sometimes takes a long time. For example, I've been working in some deals for the past 4 months because you need to get things right, especially like afterwards, like those type of things, like legal clauses that you don't think too much at the very beginning, but then come bite you afterwards. Yeah. If you
make a lot of different stuff towards.
it's quite intense. So it's hard like to get like one deal done by every 3 months. It's hard. Our capital deployment is going to take a little bit shorter. Like we are trying to deploy all the capital in the next 3 years. So, So we're putting ourselves, you know, ambitious goals to find good companies
So find good companies. Do you have like any preference in terms of, let's say, mobile gaming studios or console versus PC? Yeah. You know, you are also investing outside of games as well, right? So
yes.
Any preferences in there? Since, you know, everybody's talking about how mobile free-to-play is dead. So
Okay, my personal opinion.
Fair enough.
So, my personal opinion on free to play is not that. I think I've been hearing like that mobile games are becoming more difficult since 2012.
Oh yeah.
Every year it was like, Well, it has increased, but that doesn't mean that, for example, 2020 and 2021, all the exits that we saw over there, that was phenomenal. So if you ask some of the people that exited, and, you know, it wasn't that difficult, or like at least they made it. And it's still, mobile games is a $110 billion market, right? Only on EIPs, and Felix, you know this from an app perspective. So another 30 for there.
Yeah.
Okay, 30% there, or 30 billion. But, you know, lots of new players every day coming and developing. So what it has changed for sure is the playbook, and it has become, like, every year is becoming more competitive. Perhaps we hear less stories about two students in a dorm room hitting the jackpot with a new game, but there is stories about companies being created and launching new games. So as a VC, we still, you know, we still believe in that, and we can operate. When it comes to sectors and to your question, my preference obviously is in mobile games, because that's what I know. And I feel, you know, one part of the job, as I mentioned before, you need to be comfortable taking decisions with very limited information. And I find this as a you know, my personal experience and development, I find this extremely hard. One of the first deals that I looked at, I went to my partner and I said, "Can I pass on this? You know, I don't feel confident that I can make a decision whether it's a yes or no on this company, because I don't know much." And then my partner came back to me and say, "Look, that's the role. You know, you need to make a decision. Like, we're paying you to make a decision on things that sometimes is limited." So you can spend endless amount of time researching about the industry, talking with referrals from the founders, like speaking to people, trying to find like that level of confidence that you need to make a decision. But often you need to make the decision anyways, and you have very limited information. So when it comes to mobile games, I'm more confident on making this decision. However, that is not the only vertical that we're investing. We are also investing, I mean, I should start by the thesis, right, of our fund. And the thesis of our fund is about customer journey and user experience. What we're trying is to find industries where all the great learnings that we've seen in gaming can be also applied. And I think there's a number of examples, classic examples like Duolingo in the education. So things where, I mean, I like applied game mechanics rather than gamification, but where we see that sometimes in gaming, in mobile games, we take for granted many of the things, the great things that you do when it comes to understanding the user. So what we look is at both user acquisition, engagement, retention, and monetization. And so we try to find like ways where we can add some value over there, right? So fintech, health tech, edutech, prop tech, all those kind of like new verticals that are disrupting in some way the industries can also be can benefit from some of the things that we do at games. And you know, when it comes to games, as I mentioned, mobile games, I'm more comfortable deciding than PC console. That doesn't mean that today with the trends, you know, a lot of companies are thinking cross platform, and that's something that we need to do.
Yeah, all right. So we have, let's say, a few model situations, because obviously we are 2.5 gamers, and we reviewed a lot of games. And now, let's say, we are launching a hybrid casual game. It's three of us, me on the UA side, Felix on the monetization side, and Jakub on the game design. So we have tons of experience from the gaming industry. We're almost ready prototype, so no numbers yet. They would like to go to the soft launch, like I guess January next year, then global launch as soon as we can, based on the numbers. So I guess let's say you'd like to get raise 5 million to get the game out. So now what? So would you give us this money? Is this enough information for you? Like, what would be your thought process about about this case?
Well, I like that you start with 5 million.
Because why not?
if I think 5 million in my mind already, I'm thinking, well, you're asking for a dilution of perhaps 20%. So that puts you in a post money valuation of 25, 30.
I have no idea how this works.
Well, essentially, you would expect in every round to dilute yourself as the founder around 20%, 15 to 20%.
Okay.
Obviously, the more that you grow, the less that you would dilute yourself. So, which means that if you're 5 million already, you kind of like you're putting yourself at a relatively high valuation from the get-go.
Okay.
So then, like in my mind, like in depending on the valuation, I would be more, let's say, more diligent with the questions, and obviously the risk is higher because you're paying something. So in your case, definitely, like I would look at the team and say, like, where's your technical person, right?
Yep.
You have like a great game designer, a great
Atmo. Exactly.
And sorry, Matej, but usually UA doesn't come until you don't have a product.
I know.
So like, why would I have like someone that is doing like UA if there is no product yet? There's not going to be a product in 1 year. So you need to convince me, like, why should you have like a co-founder that is a UA person? And by the way, there's a lot of reasons to do that. Like if you're doing hybrid casual, let's say in a very publishing way, you think about like more like Voodoo style or like, you know, Ketchup, then UA is definitely part of your competitive advantage. So then
you can have we don't have the technical director. We can actually build the game.
So
we have it's almost ready. Oh, wait a second. It's almost ready. So we kind of hired someone else who are working with us. The prototype is going to be live. But okay, makes sense.
I'd say, you know, those you know, I would also try to understand, what are you trying to build? You mentioned a game.
Yeah.
But I would be curious, like, do you want to build a game that is successful, or do you want to build a company, like the next Supercell?
Okay. Interesting.
You tell me, like, now.
So let's say, okay, so it's going to be...
We're not aiming high enough, Mate. That's what he's saying.
Yeah. I'm reading between the lines, obviously. But yeah, if I say I just want to build the first game, and then based on the success, we'll build obviously multiple games, because I mean we'll need to try and start with one and then move from there. But I'm not going to try to build a new Supercell.
You're not trying to build the next Supercell.
No.
Let's end this call here.
Fair enough.
But tell me, like, why one game? What is the kind of like the problem? Like, what is the opportunity in the market that you see? I mean, we've been hearing about like hybrid casual for a while. So, are you trying to build like Hubby, like the, you know, a company that Survival.io?
So yeah, Chero? Like I think we usually discussed, and I think we talked about this on Ignite, like building a template, obviously, for hybrid casual games would be the end goal, and then we need to have like a genre expertise in, or build a template for one kind of category, and then started with one game and then branch to like 5, 10 games, whatever else. But I want to start with one, not have like a big dreams, and then suddenly when the first game fails, which obviously I guess it can, and then just move towards another one. I just don't want to say, like you said at the beginning, I don't want to say everything to convince you to give us money. So I just want to say, okay, well, let's start with one and then we'll see what happens. But I guess it's not very, very lucrative and sexy for investors to hear.
I mean, to be honest, this is a no bullshit program. I would say no, it's not very appealing because, as I say, you can bootstrap. My recommendation then would be like, why don't you just bootstrap the company, get to a state where you validate the thesis that you can build a hybrid casual game. And perhaps whenever you kind of like are decided to make really a big company, a big player in the industry, that's kind of like when you come to VC, which is one way or another. It doesn't mean that it's good or bad.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, sure. Because there is also the situation of another one where I would say, okay, well, we have 1 million, which we saved, obviously, and then now, let's use that for, like, I guess, building.
We didn't save it. We robbed a bank, Maciej. This is more fun.
Okay. We robbed the bank. We robbed the bank, and then. And then, if we want to use that for building something, and then so we have kind of like KPIs as well, and then maybe a vision for like what we want to build, then we come to the investors and say, okay, well, this is it.
But are you going to put the 1 million into the company, or?
Yeah.
Okay. So big disclaimer, as an FCA regulated, by the way, one of the perks of being in VC is that there's a lot of regulation.
Okay.
So I would never provide any financial advice.
Okay, of course. Yeah.
No, right.
This is not financial advice. No, this is not anyway. Advice. So
No.
I'm not going to say what to do, what you can do with your 1 million.
Yeah.
But if you were to put the 1 million into the company, obviously, like if you're raising from a VC, showing that you are committed both financially and in time, that definitely helps, right? Like a lot of companies, they start bootstrapping, they start, you know, like with their own funds and their own means, and when they get to an MVP or some metrics that already validate or show some signs of success, that's kind of like when they raise funds, and I think that makes total sense. But as I say, it comes down to the vision, right? If you're a founder that, hey, I'm going to put my savings, I'm very focused on profitability, I think I can get the games, like that hybrid cash flow game, to scale nicely and provide me with, you know, a great source of income and retire myself, like, you know, 5 years from now, perhaps you don't need to go for a VC. You just need to kind of like keep doing that profitably, scaling up, and then hopefully you exit the company at some point when you're poor, someone buys, and then you invite me to wherever you go.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. Any other, like, let's say, like, last advice or like advice for VC? Oh, not VC. So obviously, for the founders.
Yeah.
Before we wrap it up.
Well, I think what you said about the when to contact the VCs, right? Yeah. So I think definitely, like, you know, contact VCs like the sooner that you can. Especially in the current context. Right now we all know interest rates at 5%. It's very hard for us VCs like to fundraise. So typically, what you don't want if you are a startup is to wait until the last 3-4 months of your runway and say, now I'm going to go to a VC and start talking. I think it's, you know, the sooner the better, and building the relationship. And because a lot of, as I mentioned, a lot of the decision comes down to the team. One also advice is execute very fast. I think the hit game might not come in the first attempt. And if you are able to generate some revenues already, that can decrease your burn rate significantly and then extend your runway for a number of months. And I've seen that in a number of gaming companies, that their first games, they were not successful, but they were good enough to allow the team to iterate and work on R&D and developing games. So I think that is a good strategy if like, and diversifies from just like going the VC route and then Series A, Series B, Series C. And my last thing is always do your own diligence as well on the VCs. I think we are doing all the questions, we're making all the questions, but then you should ask also the questions on that end, like what type of VC are you? Are you going to follow up or not? Are you actually going to be hands-on and help me? VCs, we also tell a lot of stories and we oversell. The same as like a founder will say, like, hey, I'm going to build a $1 billion company. I'm going to tell the company and the founder as well, well, I'm going to help you in everything, like with HR, with, you know, technical. This is not ill-fated. It's realistic. I'm trying to help, but I'm also like doing so many other things. So in the end, you might not reach to all the things that you promised. So I think that's also good, important to know. Like if the VC, the person that you're talking to at the VC is mega VC and is already like 10 or 15 boards and
you can't possibly have time to just help everybody. Yeah.
And also like the where the VC is, at what stage is the VC, right? If it is a fundraising for the next fund, or is it about to close, things like that, right? So those are the type of things that you also need to consider.
Nice. Okay, perfect. Thanks. Great. No, it's I think you can we can wrap up here, and thanks for Nacho, thanks for coming and talking to us about all the VC and then telling us to be a little bit more prepared for pitching our idea.
Are you gonna send me your deck? Like
we'll
two
see.
And a half gamers.
We'll see about that. As soon as it's ready, then definitely yes.
What is like? So I'm curious to hear what is your view for hybrid casual? I've been hearing about hybrid casual for a long time. So
it's from the games that we kind of reviewed. It's a very good combination of both worlds because the monetization is 50-50, right? So that can kind of, that can work really well on the UA side and also on the monetization side. But then if you think about also the retention profile, it's day one is great, but then like the long term is great as well, because you're kind of like borrowing the IRP monetization and the depth of the game and everything. So it's like, yeah, it's good, like the best from both worlds. And obviously not as easy to build as everybody thinks, because also Voodoo is doing this. They didn't do it that well. All my games are doing this as well. They are very far from the rest of the crowd. And I think Say Games is doing the best job at the moment.
Hobby and Say Games.
Hobby is the different category. That's a very different category. So I think the outlook for the hybrid casual is quite good already.
I mean, I like the games. Arcade games, classic, power apps and progressing. Yeah. Super good. Nice. Yeah, if you ever come across, or if anyone listening comes across like a good deck, I'm online. And please.
Yeah, we'll put
see you at RubyCon.
We'll see you at RubyCon.
RubyCon/ I'll be there. Hoping to get invited to all the good, cool parties, and then, you know, have fun.
All right. Thanks, man.
All right.
Thanks very much for listening. Until next time. Cheers.
Ciao. Thank you. Bye-bye.